From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is adding more fuel to the fire over the border wall fight, attacking on Twitter the 16 states that joined together yesterday to sue the Trump administration over its emergency declaration, which would take money from the military to spend on the wall. The states are led by California. Today, Trump tweeted that state's failed fast train project was hundreds of times more expensive than the desperately needed wall. California Attorney General Javier Becerra talked about the basis for the lawsuit yesterday on MSNBC.
The president, he admitted there's no crisis at the border, and he's now trying to rob funds that were allocated by Congress legally to the various states and the people of our states. And so the separation of powers being violated, we're going to go out there and make sure that Donald Trump cannot steal money from the states and the people who need them, since we paid the taxpayer dollars to Washington, D.C. to get those services.
Meanwhile, there are other lawsuits pending against the emergency declaration, including one from the nonprofit Public Citizen on behalf of landowners along the border who feel their land will be stolen from them. Yvette Gaitan of La Rosita, Texas, an unincorporated area in Stark County right along the border, says she's in favor of border security through better policies, like forcing people to go through ports of entry to claim asylum, not crossing illegally, then turning themselves in. But Yvette, you also say a border wall would cut off your access to part of your property, which has been in your family for quite a while?
Yes, it's about six generations. It's my roots. It's my heritage. It's the people that I know, of course, my grandparents. I didn't get to meet my great-grandparents or my great-great-grandparents. My father was raised here along with his siblings. Me and my siblings, we were raised here. We didn't spend much time indoors. We were always outdoors, fishing, running around, climbing trees, playing little wars, just enjoying it.
Yeah. And you were raising a family there now. It's paid off. Did you get a letter from the government?
Yes, I received the first letter for the right of entry in September.
And what more did it say?
And that they just wanted to do some surveying for possible barriers, smart wall towers, different kind of things that they would like to put out there.
Well, this was a letter from the Army Corps of Engineers and Customs and Border Protection. And now we know that President Trump has declared this national emergency. And what he'd like to put up there is a wall. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't think it's possible to put a wall back there. And I don't think it's necessary. I mean, there is illegal crossings. I haven't personally seen anybody crossing through our property. You do see it on the news. You do hear about it. But I believe there's other ways he can do to go ahead and secure our borders besides putting an expensive and useless wall where it doesn't need to be.
Well, look, would you have to move, by the way, or is this wall just cut through your property there by the Rio Grande?
That's where the uncertainty is. They're not clear about how much property they want. They're not clear about any of it, actually.
Well, and if they do have to take property, you know, the government has seized lands in the past to build post offices, to enlarge the Gettysburg battlefield and the Redwoods to secure safe water. You know, the thinking is that the federal government does what it has to do because millions of Americans will benefit, even if a handful of Americans suffer, as it sounds like you will. Your thoughts about that thinking, that this is for the safety and security of all of America?
Well, if that were true, they would be working on policy, not building a wall. That's why they come here, because of what they are offered. And they pretty much get a lot of things handed to them. Yes, a lot of them will work after that. A lot of them will provide for their own families, but a lot of them don't. They still get things handed to them when they get here. So if policy stays the same, they're going to find a way to get through.
Well, and also the president himself, and much is being made of the fact that the president himself said he didn't need to do this. He just wanted to do it quickly. How did that hit you?
That was just like a slap in the face because he doesn't need to do it. That means there is no emergency.
Yeah. What else will happen, do you feel, to your property if there's a wall there?
The peace, the tranquility is going to be gone.
Yeah. You also mentioned you're on a floodplain.
Yes, we're on the floodplains. So my home is downhill and the water drains to the river. So if you create a wall and all this debris starts to clutter and clog it, what's going to happen? where's that water going to go?
So what are you going to do? You're part of this lawsuit. You've asked, the government has asked to come survey. Are you going to let them?
No. They're going to have to do, take me to court and have a judge order me to let them to, because I will not willingly.
That's Yvette Gaitan of La Rosita, Texas, a landowner. Her property would be impacted by President Trump's border wall, and she's now part of a lawsuit against the National Emergency Declaration. Yvette, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, the Army is having a hard time meeting higher recruitment goals set by the Trump administration. Recruiters fell thousands short of last year's goal of more than 76,000 new troops. That was the first time that's happened in more than a decade. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports on one strategy to get more people to enlist, convince educators of the value of military service.
All right, you guys, welcome to Fort Carson. I'm Sergeant First Class Stone.
About 20 people from an assortment of Colorado high schools huddle in a group at the sprawling Army base just outside Colorado Springs. Teachers, counselors, administrators. It's cold, it's windy, and it is snowing.
You guys just so happen to pick the best day of the year to come.
They are nevertheless forging ahead with this day-long tour of the base. Led around a fleet of military vehicles, troop carriers and the like, some weighing 30-plus tons. The educators climb in and out of the various rigs, supervised by soldiers in full battle garb. Army Captain Wes Barber says recruiting strategy used to be focused on the bravery and the thrill inherent in military life.
That bravado that you're talking about, there are still folks out there that want that. There are still folks out there that just want to serve their country.
There's no guarantee new recruits in Colorado will wind up at Fort Carson, but those who do are likely to see some kind of action overseas. The base has one of the busiest deployment schedules in the country. Barber says to reach the Trump administration's higher recruitment goals, the Army has to appeal to more than a young person's sense of adventure. He's hoping to show these teachers the military is a smart professional and academic choice for career-minded kids.
I would conjecture that when you join the military, you are in fact choosing college.
That's Larry Beer. He's an education services specialist with the Army. Beer speaks to the teachers in a large gymnasium, an enormous American flag taking up much of the wall behind them. Beer says the Army can be part of a serious collegiate plan right from the start, explaining recruits can earn college credit through their training process, even in basic training. There are more than 150 career options in the Army.
Those represent IT, they represent medical fields, HR, logistics. Anyone heard of Amazon?
The Army is pushing this more academically-minded approach in tours like this, and also in broad new efforts online, through social media, fielding teams in video game tournaments, and more. David Armstrong is an English teacher at Los Animas High School in southern Colorado. He says the tour is broadening his perspective of what the Army can provide.
When I was in high school, you know, it was a lot of the give me a gun and we'll go out and do what we got to do and then we'll come home and GI Bill. But their job is not just to carry a gun and a 50-pound backpack and go shoot people. You know, it's to, in some cases, be an operating room specialist.
All the teachers here volunteered to come on this tour, and everyone I speak with is coming away with a positive impression of the options in the Army. They're also having some fun while they're at it. They move on to a series of semi-trailers posted side by side in a parking lot. Inside the trailers, several stations, imitating the driver's seats of some of those vehicles the teachers were shown earlier. The windshields are replaced by flat-screen televisions, and the teachers take part in an elaborate simulation, a video game, really.
Do I have to follow her?
Kate Bridgman is taking her turn behind the wheel.
I'm the English language development teacher at Cheyenne Mountain High School.
Many of her students are green card holders, considering the military as a path to citizenship. She's never been on Fort Carson, after living and working near it for years. She says she's glad she's getting a more thorough understanding of a part of military life.
As an educator, I need to look at all avenues for my kids, what they're ready for, what they're looking for, and that the military has certainly developed a much more diverse kind of approach.
And recruiters in Colorado and around the country have their work cut out for them. because young people right now do have a lot of options. The strong private sector economy pulling some potential soldiers away.
Go ahead and get in the prone firing position.
The tour ends with a visit to a virtual firing range. Sergeant Chris England has the teachers lay down with their imitation AR-15s.
Okay. Everybody's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody's ready to go?
While the Army might be more than just shooting, shooting is definitely still part of it. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
Another military story we're following today. President Trump is expected to sign a policy directive this afternoon to create a space force as a sixth branch of the military. More on that story later on All Things Considered. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders announced today that he is running for president again. He was the runner-up in the 2016 Democratic primary, and he joins a crowded field that includes Senators Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, and more. And Democrat Pete Buttigieg. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He recently launched a presidential exploratory committee, and he joins us now as part of our series of conversations with the candidates for 2020. Mayor, welcome. And you are 37. If you're elected president, you'd be the youngest ever. Do you worry about experience and the experience that you have already?
I think it's a fair question, but I would actually say my experience is one of the main reasons for me to be in this conversation. Look, I get that being a mayor is not as conventional a background as having spent a long time in Washington and in the U.S. Congress or in an environment like that. But I actually think the more we can get Washington to start looking like our best-run cities and towns and not the other way around, the better. You know, an executive, especially in a strong mayor system like the one that I've been governing in for going on 8 years, that's a role where you are on the hook for everything. There is no one else to call. When you get something hitting your desk that could be anything from an economic development deal to an officer-involved shooting or an emergency operations center activation for a weather situation, you learn the urgency of public service and government work. And for what it's worth, I have more years of government experience under my belt than the president and more years of executive experience than the vice president and more years of military experience than I think anybody to reach that office since George H.W. Bush. So I get that I'm the youngest person in the conversation, but I think experience is one of the main reasons I hope to be taken seriously.
I want to ask you about Afghanistan. You served in Afghanistan. What do you think of the president's efforts to draw down troops there and to negotiate a peace deal with the Taliban?
Well, we're leaving Afghanistan. The only question is, are we going to leave well or are we going to leave poorly? I think one thing that the left, increasingly the right, here in America, not to mention the Taliban and the Afghan government, are all pretty much on the same page on is that the American presence has to find its way to an end. And, you know, having served in that war for what I believe to be its tail end now 5 years ago when I took a leave of absence from the mayor's office to deploy there, and now being at a point where you could be old enough to enlist and have not even been alive when 9/11 happened, we just can't go on with endless war. But if we do this in the wrong way, if, for example, we fail to get guarantees that Afghanistan will not be used as a terrorist base for terrorist attacks against the U.S. homeland, if we conduct policy by the president issuing Twitter dicta that surprise his own generals and intelligence chiefs, if we pursue a pattern of dialogue with the Taliban that doesn't even include the elected Afghan government, then I think we do run the risk of leaving poorly.
But you would be willing to trust the Taliban in some sort of deal, even though they were the ones who allowed al-Qaeda to plan 9/11 within Afghanistan, which is the reason we went in the first place?
If the Taliban are serious about putting down their arms and coming to the table, then I think there has to be an engagement there. Now, the reality is we're going to have to maintain some kind of intelligence and special operations capability, as we do around the world, in order to defend American lives. But I do think that it is in the Taliban's interest, as well as ours, for us to find a way out of this. I just don't think it's appropriate for us to do anything that would come as a surprise to the legitimately elected Afghan government.
What do you think is the biggest mistake that the U.S. is currently making when it comes to foreign policy? Or what would you first change?
Well, America First has really come to mean America alone. And the fundamental mistake of American policy is failing to realize that we can either resent the rest of the world or we can lead it, but we cannot do both. The next president is going to have a lot of work to do simply restoring American credibility around the world. We have to meet the challenges of a new century in a way that builds faith among our allies, that demonstrates that we believe American values and American interests are not only compatible but mutually reinforcing. And we've got to have a clear and, frankly, higher threshold for when we're going to threaten to use military force. I mean, the idea that the National Security Advisor, one of the people who helped lead us into the Iraq War, I'm not even sure why he's in this role to begin with, but the idea that he would be, using a conspicuously placed notepad to try to signal that we were contemplating military action to deal with Venezuela is exactly the wrong kind of attitude to take if we want to demonstrate that we're serious about the threshold for the commitment of American forces in the future.
You're talking about John Bolton.
Yes.
What about China? What about with respect to our economic power and how the Trump administration is using it? Do you think that their tough on China trade approach right now is the right one?
Well, we certainly need to hold China accountable for things from currency manipulation to intellectual property theft. At the same time, we can also very easily move into a self-defeating territory if the rhetoric is not part of a strategy. You know, where I come from in the industrial Midwest, we have some companies that make steel. We have more companies that buy steel. They are less competitive in the environment of a trade war. So I'm not sure that there's really a strategy behind any of this. And we need to be cognizant not only that the way we handle our trade is going to have serious implications for workers in places like where I come from, we also need to recognize that China is competing with us not only in economic and not only in hard power but also in soft power. They are undertaking efforts to fund infrastructure development in developing countries around the world that in many ways represent the future. And if they're there and we're not, then we are going to be increasingly left behind in the 21st century.
You think the United States should do something like the Belt and Road Initiative that China is doing and building all this infrastructure around the world?
Well, if we get it right, it could lead to more American jobs as well as more American influence. And, again, at our best, historically, we have been prepared to make investments in the world around us for strategic reasons, knowing that that benefits not only the countries that we're helping but also the American people.
I want to ask you about some of the big stories going on in this country right now, starting with the news that Amazon last week scrapped plans for its second headquarters in New York City. Senator Bernie Sanders congratulated New York for, quote, standing up to Amazon. Senator Elizabeth Warren said the incentives that had been offered to Amazon were taxpayer bribes. Where do you come down on this whole debate right now about whether it makes sense for cities and towns to try to entice corporations by offering big tax breaks? And do you think New York was wrong to let Amazon go?
You know, as soon as you take office as a mayor, you begin to feel this pressure basically to buy jobs. And there's a kind of an older model of economic development that we sometimes call smokestack chasing, based on the idea that if you can just get the big factory or the big office building, it'll solve all your problems. And so you will do anything and pay anything in order to land it. What I learned very quickly in South Bend is that you can't look for a silver bullet, but also that economic development incentives do have their place. We use them, but we set parameters and boundaries around them. Because what you want to be doing is perhaps buying down some infrastructure hurdle or being a tiebreaker, not using the taxpayer to take what would be a bad business decision and turn it into a good one. If we want it to make business sense for somebody to move to our community, then we better make sure there's strong public education and quality infrastructure and safe neighborhoods and good parks and all the things people are looking for, because companies are made of people. So economic development incentives have their place. But that doesn't mean that you can and actually, I think the example that's most vividly showing this now is what's happening in Wisconsin with Foxconn. Even when you do land a company also, often you're landing one, if they're that sensitive to incentives, that may not be that sticky and may respond to somebody else's incentives in a few short years.
So is that a yes, it was good for New York to let Amazon go, or no, it was bad for them to do that?
I mean, I would have liked to see them come to terms that perhaps were a little bit less, a little less on the backs of the taxpayer, but could still bring those jobs in. And I'm not attuned to all of the finer points of what was negotiated, other than that I noticed that not as many parties were talking to each other that should have. So more dialogue would have served them well, and I think they probably could have worked out something that was mutually beneficial. But I am skeptical of the deal as it was being set up.
Do you think that the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam, should resign?
I do. I think that at the end of the day, whether you should continue to hold office is based on your ability to lead. And I think he lost so much confidence, not only with this horrifying racist imagery that was associated with his yearbook page, but also his handling of it, a press conference that left people, I think, less confident of him at the end than at the beginning. Ultimately, it's for Virginians to weigh in on more than somebody like me, but that's certainly how it looks from where I'm sitting.
Pete Buttigieg, you would be the first openly gay president of the United States. Do you think, given the sexism that Hillary Clinton dealt with, does it worry you that maybe the country is not ready for a gay president right now?
My short answer is there's probably only one way to find out for sure. I will say it worried me a whole lot when I realized in my personal life when I came back from my deployment that it was time to move forward, have a life, and therefore that meant I needed to come out. And I, inconveniently, that happened in the middle of a reelection campaign, and it happened while Mike Pence was the governor of my state. And in the end, I got reelected with 80% of the vote, even in a socially conservative community like South Bend, Indiana. So what that told me was that, at least in that case, people were prepared to evaluate me and vote based on their judgment of the job that I was doing.
Since then, though, have you faced any hurdles as a result of your sexual orientation?
Yeah, there's always some ugliness online, but the truth is most people seem to send me one of two signals. Either that they recognize the potential historic nature of a candidacy like mine, that I would be the first out elected official ever even seeking this office, and that has in some way moved them or inspired them, especially if they're in the same boat. And another number of people, probably a larger number of people, who have in some way made it clear to me that they don't care. And that's historic too in its own way and very welcome.
That is Pete Buttigieg, who is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He has formed a Presidential Exploratory Committee for 2020. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
The founder of the Chinese telecom giant Huawei is speaking out about the December arrest of his daughter and Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. In an interview with the BBC, Ren Zhengfei called Meng's arrest by Canadian authorities politically motivated and slammed a U.S.-led campaign to shut Huawei's technology out of 5G networks. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
There's no way the U.S. can crush us. The world needs Huawei because we are more advanced. And because the U.S. keeps targeting us and finding fault with us, it has forced us to improve our products and services.
Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the Justice Department unveiled sweeping charges against Meng Wanzhou, accusing her of stealing trade secrets, obstructing a criminal investigation, and violating U.S. sanctions laws. Her father, who, as we said, is the CEO, had avoided passing judgment on the arrest before this interview. But here is what he says now. Listen.
I object to what the U.S. has done. This kind of politically motivated act is not acceptable. The U.S. likes to sanction others whenever there's an issue.
Ali, why is he speaking out now?
Well, it's his first broadcast internationally since his daughter was arrested. And I think at this point it's going to the courts. So he now needs to sort of take a position. And the position he's taken is that Huawei is massive. It's huge. It sells more smartphones than Apple does, fewer than Samsung does. It is the world's largest telecommunications maker. And the United States is a portion of its business, an important portion nonetheless. And if the U.S. continues to influence its allies to say, don't buy from Huawei, it's going to hurt Huawei's business. He's on a little bit of shaky ground, though. Number one, he sort of described his relationship with his children as not very close because he was in the military for so long. And he didn't have good answers for the interviewer about the fears that America and the West have that a Chinese telecommunications company, even though it's China's largest private company, could be sharing information with the Chinese government. It is, by the way, part of Chinese law that Chinese companies have to participate in government activities. The question is, does that include spying? Mm-hmm. He says no, but I will say, listening to the translated interview, didn't seem all that convincing in the way he said it.
What about the fact that this is all going on as the U.S. and China are starting a new round of trade talks today? How much does what's happening here with Huawei fit into the bigger picture of trade between the U.S. and China?
You know, it's hard to know because we don't know what the motivations were for the United States to extradite his daughter from Canada and why the charges were laid in the first place. Ostensibly, some of the charges have to do with Huawei's business in Iran, which contravenes U.S. law. So they're legitimate in, on the face of it. But they did come in the midst of the the worst of the discussions between China and the United States. What's interesting is Huawei is a private company, which is interesting in China. It, you know, it doesn't mean it's not tied to the government, but it is China's largest private company. So there is something to what Mr. Ren says, that this might be as political as it is anything else. That's going to be hard to glean, but most observers say this feels political.
That is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Thanks, Ali.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And now the story of Huda Muthana. It's a cautionary one. She's the 24-year-old Alabama woman who ran away to Syria 4 years ago to join ISIS and now wants to come home. When she was with ISIS, she used social media to call for bloody attacks in the U.S. She now says she was ignorant and brainwashed. She says she ran away from ISIS with her 18-month-old son, had a brutal trek before turning herself over to Kurdish forces. She's now in the Al-Hol refugee camp in northern Syria. Hassan Shibli is chief executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Florida chapter. He's also an attorney representing Huda's family. Hassan, she's talked to reporters. How's she doing?
She's doing all right. She's very fearful right now, very scared, because she has spoken out against ISIS very publicly, and there are still ISIS supporters and sympathizers within that vicinity. So she's right now very scared for her life. One of her friends' young daughters just died due to disease in the camp. It's a very disorganized, very messy situation. So they're still very afraid for their life. But I also get the sense that she feels a burden lifted off her shoulders now that she's come out publicly condemning ISIS and realizing how they had brainwashed her and manipulated her and really turned her into a person that she now is disgusted to have been. So I do feel a great sense of relief in her as well.
Well, but she also said things online like asking Americans to go on drive-bys, spill all their blood. This is Americans. Rent a big truck and drive all over them. Veterans, patriots, Memorial Day, kill them.
Those messages are horrible and disgusting, and frankly, they sound like a lot of the hate messages I get by anti-Muslim bigots in America calling for all Muslims to be killed. So it's nasty, it's disgusting, it's horrible. Nothing can justify such disgusting tweets. What we do know for a fact is that those tweets did come out in a period right after, I guess, her first husband was killed. We also know she actually lost control over her social media while she was there. So we don't truly know what tweets actually came out from her. We know that she had been wanting to leave for some time. But listen, at the end of the day, we know that she is disgusted by the person she was. She deeply, deeply regrets it. She, in fact, was only 19 years old when she was manipulated and brainwashed. I mean, these guys essentially preyed on her, manipulated her, brainwashed her, brought her over there, and took advantage of her for their purposes. And I think she's finally awoken, and she deeply regrets it, and she's willing to pay whatever debt she has to society. And I think right now she really wants to be a powerful voice to condemn ISIS and to protect others from being manipulated in the way she was and protect others from making the same horrible mistakes that she had made.
We should say she comes from a Muslim family, but one that does not have extreme views. They were horrified.
About all Muslim families. Of course, she comes from a normal Muslim family. You know, Muslims are a part of the society. We're human just like everyone else. You know, you don't have to be Muslim or Christian or Jewish to know that violence is wrong. You know, these criminal organizations, they really don't care about religion. At the end of the day, they're no different than sex traffickers and violent criminal gangs that prey on vulnerable young youth to recruit them for their nefarious purposes.
Well, you talk about her wanting to come back. Just this past Sunday, President Trump urged Western countries to repatriate captured fighters. As The Guardian notes, his administration has shown little enthusiasm for doing that. But he said the U.S. is asking other countries to take back over 800 ISIS fighters captured in Syria and put them on trial. Is she willing to go on trial?
Absolutely. She is willing to turn herself in. I actually called the FBI on her behalf yesterday. I said, listen, we know where she is. She wants to turn herself in, and she wants to face the legal system. And then she will accept whatever outcome of that legal system is. If she has a debt to society, she wants to pay that debt. And she wants to move on with her life. But before that, she really wants to speak out to protect other vulnerable young women in particular from being manipulated and brainwashed in the same way that she was.
Yeah. What did the people you spoke to say?
It almost seems to be falling on deaf ears right now. The government has known where she is for quite some time. In fact, one of her other attorneys contacted the government about a month ago to inform them of her whereabouts, and they've made absolutely no effort to go and interview her, to question her, to even determine whether she's still a threat or not. And I think that's very disturbing, given that since she turned herself into the PKK, already The Guardian's been able to interview her in person. The New York Times has been able to interview her in person. It seems like those major media outlets are doing a better intelligence job than our own government officials at this point.
Well, what is her backup plan? If the U.S. says you cannot come back, even though you regret it, you fought with ISIS. She's got an 18-month-old son. What does she do?
I think then she's going to have to find a way to survive over there. There is a fear that the PKK may turn her over to the Syrians, which I think is very problematic. The Syrian government has the worst human rights record in the world. Otherwise, there is also a fear right now, and she's taking a big risk by speaking out against ISIS, because there is a legitimate fear that the PKK may exchange her with ISIS in a prisoner swap. And if she gets back into ISIS hands, that's definitely a death sentence for her at this point.
That's Hassan Shibli, attorney and chief executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations Florida chapter, acting a spokesperson for the family of Huda Muthanna, who ran away from her home in Alabama to join ISIS and wants to come home with an 18-month-old child. Hassan, thank you.
It's a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much, Robin.
We're going to hear more about the Al-Hol refugee camp, but meanwhile, some 200 Syrian families are trapped elsewhere in the last part of Syria still controlled by ISIS and still being bombed by the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS. On the ground, the Syrian Democratic Forces, supported by American advisors, are on the brink of defeating the terror group, but today the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights said ISIS is keeping hundreds of these family members from leaving. Cole Bakkenfeld is head of Middle East Advocacy for the International Rescue Committee. He's in Washington. Cole, are relief agencies able to get into this area controlled by ISIS?
Not at the front lines there. Obviously, you know, that is an area of active fighting. For relief agencies like IRC and others, what we are able to do is treat people when they do reach Al-Hol camp, which is, dozens of kilometers away from those front lines.
The Al-Hol camp, the refugee camp where people like a young American woman who now regrets joining ISIS are. We hear many women and children are there. In fact, some gangs are forming of Russian women versus Tunisian women. It doesn't feel very safe. 40,000 people, how are you trying to help them?
Well, the situation at Al-Hol is extremely dire for a few reasons. One is the real swell in population. I mean, just since December, you've seen about 30,000 people arrive at this camp. This is triple the size it once was. So one is it's a capacity issue, right? It's really bursting at the seams. And there were several weeks where people were sleeping in the open. There weren't enough tents. There weren't enough blankets. And this is in the dead of winter in Syria. The second, you know, obviously is these people arrive in a really desperate state. In order to reach the camp, they often have to walk for 2 days, more than 20 miles, just to get to a screening center if and when they are approved and then are relocated to the camp. These are people that have walked through the desert barefoot, you know, through mined areas and so on.
Huda Muthana, the young girl from Alabama, talks of eating grass on that trek to try to get out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, this is a desolate area. This is the middle of the desert. I mean, these are really vulnerable groups, as you mentioned, the majority of them women and children. And so we do hear a lot of reports of abuse along the way. Mm-hmm. And really, because of the dire state that they're in, paired with the conditions, it's really unfortunate. We've seen now up to 62 deaths of people that had died along the way or shortly thereafter. And the majority of those are babies less than a year old.
This started in 2011 as a peaceful protest and uprising during the Arab Spring, turned into a very violent civil war, then eventually a proxy war. The U.S., Israel, the Kurds on one side, Russia, Iran, Syria on the other. 13 million Syrians displaced, the country in ruins. You're going to the region soon, and the International Rescue Committee has been working there since 2012. Can Syria come back?
In the long term, you know, you have whole generations of Syrians who haven't been in school for several years, haven't been working for several years, have long-term health issues. And so this will be a massive problem for a long time to come.
In the short term, we understand that trucks have gone into this ISIS-held area to try to get some people out. Do you think ISIS will let those civilians there leverage their shields go?
Well, what we have heard is that they are trying to prevent people from leaving, and then in some sense it gives them some security and so on. But we have seen quite a few people escape. You know, just at the Al-Hol camp, we're seeing about 700 people arrive each day and night. So people are escaping and getting out and making that treacherous journey, making that gamble that they really have to get out of that area.
Well, Cole Bockenfeld, Middle East Advocacy Director for the International Rescue Committee, thank you for your work and thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll continue to follow both of these stories, an American woman who fought for ISIS who now wants to come home and Syrian families who want to leave their home. We'll follow them both.
Officials in a number of states are working on legislation to legalize sports betting after the Supreme Court struck down a ban last year, leaving the issue up to states. And now a number of media companies are looking at how to cash in. Let's turn to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Peter Kafka is executive editor at Recode and joins us. Peter, we know that fantasy betting sites like DraftKings and FanDuel are getting into sports betting, but why could this be big money for media companies as well?
The media guys have been looking at this for more than a year, assuming that sports gambling would be legal and trying to figure out how they would cash in. They know lots of people gamble illegally today. They're assuming as that becomes legal, there'll be opportunities for them to participate. And then the question is how? And there's a range of options ranging from pretty basic to pretty complicated.
So explain, what are some of the pretty basic, what are some of the pretty complicated options of how they do that?
The basic one, there are many of the media companies are already in, which is, hey, we're going to put on programming that's appealing to people who bet on sports, ranging from the actual games to programming that's directed specifically at sports betting. I think over time, even if you're not sports betting, when you're watching an NFL game, something like that, you're going to see a lot more information directed at sports gamblers in the same way that a lot of fantasy sports information now populates your screen when you're watching an NFL game. A medium version of this is taking advertising from people who are in the sports betting industry. And the most complicated thing would actually become a sports betting company themselves, i.e. taking bets from gamblers. That's pretty hard to do, but I think some companies are looking at it.
Are companies worried at all about being associated with the part of gambling that may not be so appealing in general? People get addicted to gambling. There are reasons why companies have stayed away from it in the past.
Yeah, I think in the past, the legality was first and foremost, and morality was secondary. And it'll be interesting over the next couple of years to see which companies say, all right, look, if this is legal, we're going to do it. And which companies say, you know what, I'm not comfortable with this either because I don't think it's moral or because I'm worried about liability. I was at the NBA All-Star Weekend last week where I heard a lot about all this. And one of the companies that's involved in sports betting today told me Google won't take their ad money. So you've got Google, for whatever reason, saying this is money we refuse to take right now. Again, that might change over time. Disney was at one point supposed to invest in DraftKings. This was called a fantasy sports site at the time, and backed out at the very end. And everyone assumes that's for sort of moral / legal mm-hmm. considerations.
Earlier this month, Bleacher Report, which is a sports journalism site owned by AT&T, announced that it will actually start producing a sports gambling show from Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. Are you seeing that a lot, that these companies will be just producing content to attract sports bettors?
That's definitely going to happen. I think every media company that has sports programming now is going to either create stuff specifically for sports betting or to amp it up a little bit. And by the way, the leagues themselves are embracing this. First and foremost, the NBA, which has been pushing for this for a couple of years now.
And is the idea that the media companies would actually be taking the bets themselves in the future, or maybe not at all?
That is the most difficult thing to pull off for a couple reasons. A major one is that sports betting is going to be legalized state by state. Each state is going to have its own regulations. And so if you're a company that wants to take sports bets, you have to comply with various state regulations. I think that'll be pretty hard for a big media company like a Disney or an AT&T or a Fox to pull off. But you might still see them try it. For the record, I asked AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson whether his company was going to be doing this or the ones who own Bleacher Report. And he said, no, we're not going to be taking bets.
Where do you see this all going? Is sports betting just going to become much bigger with all of these big mainstream companies getting involved?
That's my major question, and I don't have a good answer for it. I was talking with a bunch of the sports betting companies last week, and my major question is, do you plan on converting people who are not sports bettors into sports bettors, or are you going to take the people who are sports betting illegally today and take their money? And right now, they're going to go where the market is, which is people who are already betting on sports, legally or not, and getting them to direct some of their money that way. To me, the more interesting question is what happens to people who weren't betting on sports in the past and now decide, well, I've got my phone, I'm watching a game, and mm-hmm. it's easy to click with a button and put money on it. I think that's a big deal for both society and the media companies.
And do you think there are going to be a lot of those people that decide, you know what, maybe I will bet on sports?
I think ultimately that's their hope. If you look in the UK where sports betting is legal, almost all the sports betting happens in-game. You're watching a game, you weren't planning on betting, but all of a sudden a wager pops up on your phone and you decide, heck, I'll put $10 on whether or not this team scores a goal in the next 15 minutes. To me, that really changes the way you interact with sports. And also it's a little bit concerning, at least for a fuddy-duddy like me. You take something like a phone, which already has lots of addictive properties. You marry that with gambling, which can be addictive, and you potentially have a big mess on your hands.
By the way, you were at the NBA All-Star Weekend. Did you happen to catch the Hamidou Diallo dunk over Shaq while you were there?
I did not. I only saw one game. It turns out that you're actually not supposed to go to the games during NBA All-Star Weekend. You're supposed to go to the parties. So I figured that out a little too late.
Peter Kafka, executive editor at Recode. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was some dunk.
It was unbelievable. He came down the court, went over Shaq, who didn't flinch, and then hung on the rim.
Hung on the rim.
Unbelievable.
Could have gone wrong in so many ways, but yes. It didn't. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We're now going to try that. It's Here and Now.